This is Audible.
Robert Leckie was a young sports reporter when he enlisted right after Pearl Harbor. Intent on a career as a writer, Leckie told his father that he would fight the Japanese during the day and write about it at night. Unfortunately, the Japanese rarely allowed for such convenient scheduling. Instead, Leckie would wait until he returned home to write about repelling nocturnal bonsai attacks on Guadalcanal, debauching through a 9-month liberty in Australia, enduring the soul-deadening primordial conditions on Cape Gloucester, and surviving a grievous wounding on Peleliu. Through it all, Leckie retained an irreverent view of all authority and a deep attachment to his comrades. It was that attitude and those attachments that helped him survive the war in the Pacific and why we chose Helmet for My Pillow for our project. Playtone was also fortunate in the casting of James Badge Dale to play Robert Leckie. Badge perfectly captured Leckie's gimlet-eyed view of all things military, but also his open-hearted embrace of his fellow Marines. While making the Pacific, we got to know Robert Leckie's family. They told us that to an uncanny degree, James Badge Dale's performance embodied much of what they remembered most about their husband and father. The shrewd intelligence and the combative personality, but also the vulnerability he was never able to completely camouflage. Playtone and Audible are honored that Badge reprises and expands on that role in his reading of Helmet for My Pillow. Robert Leckie became an enormously successful historian and remained close with a number of the men you will meet in this book. Speaking for Playtone and for Audible, we are proud to bring you this remarkable book. I'm Tom Hanks.
Audible Inc. presents Helmet for My Pillow, From Paris Island to the Pacific, a young Marine's stirring account of combat in World War II. Written by Robert Leckie. Narrated by James Badge Dale. With a bonus introduction read by Tom Hanks.
The Battle of the Teneroo, August 21st, 1942. By Robert Leckie. A helmet for my pillow, a poncho for my bed. My rifle rests across my chest. The stars swing overhead. The whisper of the kunai, the murmur of the sea, the sighing palm and night so calm, betray no enemy. Here, river bank so silent, you men who sleep around, that foreign scream across the stream, up, fire at the sound, sweeping over the sand spit that blocks the Teneroo, with bonsai boast a mushroomed host vows to destroy our few. Into your holes and gun pits, kill them with rifles and knives, feed them with lead until they are dead, and widowed are their wives, sons of the mothers who gave you honor and gift of birth. Strike with the knife till blood and life run out upon the earth. Marines, keep faith with your glory, keep to your trembling hole. Intruder feel of Nippon steel can't penetrate your soul. Closing, they charge all howling, their breast all targets large. The gun must shake, the bullets make a slaughter of their charge. Red are the flashing tracers, yellow the bursting shells. Hoarse is the cry of men who die, shrill are the wounded's yells. God, how the night reels stricken. She shrieks with orange spark. The mortars lash and cannons crash have crucified the dark. Falling the faltering foemen, beneath our guns lie heaped. By greenish glare of rockets' flare we see the harvest reaped. Now has the first fierce onslaught been broken and hurled back. Hammered and hit, from hole and pit, we rise up to attack. Day bursts pale from a gun tube. The gibbering night has fled. By light of dawn, the foe has drawn a line behind his dead. Our tanks clank in behind him. Our riflemen move out. Their hearts have met our bayonet. It's ended with a shout. Cease fire, the words go ringing. Over the heaps of the slain, the battle's won. The rising sun lies riddled on the plain. Saint Michael, angel of battle, we praise you to God on high. The foe you gave was strong and brave, and unafraid to die. Speak to the Lord for our comrades, killed when the battle seemed lost. They went to meet a bright defeat, the hero's holocaust. False is the vaunt of the victor, empty our living pride. For those who fell, there is no hell, not for the brave who died. Chapter 1. Boot. 1. A cutting wind slanted up Church Street in the cheerless dawn of January 5, 1942. That day I departed for the United States Marines. The War with Japan was not yet 4 weeks old. Wake Island had fallen. Pearl Harbor was a real tragedy, a burning, bitter humiliation. Hastily composed war songs were on the lips of everyone, their heavy patriotism failing to compensate for what they lacked in tune and spirit. Hysteria seemed to crouch behind all eyes. But none of this meant much to me. I was aware of my father beside me, bending into the wind with me. I could feel the wound in my lower regions, still fresh, still sore. The sutures had been removed a few days earlier. I had sought to enlist the day after Pearl Harbor, but the Marines had insisted that I be circumcised. It cost me $100, although I'm not sure to this day whether I paid the doctor or not. But I am certain that few young men went off to war in that fateful time so marked. We had come across the Jersey Meadows, riding the Erie commuter line, and then on the ferry over the Hudson River to downtown New York. Breakfast at home had been subdued. My mother was up and about. She did not cry. It was not a heart-rending leave-taking, nor was it brave, resolute, any of those words that fail to describe the thing. It was like so much else in this war that was to produce unbounded heroism, yet not a single stirring song. It was resigned. She followed me to the door with sad eyes and said, "God keep you." It had been a silent trip across the meadows, and it was a wordless goodbye in front of the bronze revolving doors at 90 Church Street. My father embraced me quickly, and just as quickly averted his face and left. The Irish doorman measured me and smiled. I went inside and joined the United States Marines. The captain who swore us in reduced the ceremony to a jumble. We all held up our hands. We put them down when he lowered his. That way we guessed we were Marines. The master gunnery sergeant who became our momentary shepherd made the fact plainer to us. Those rich, mellow, blasphemous oaths that were to become so familiar to me flowed from his lips with the consummate ease of one who had spent a lifetime in vituperation. I would meet his masters later. Presently, as he herded us across the river to Hoboken in a waiting train, he seemed to be beyond comparison. But he was gentle and kind enough when he said goodbye to the 30 or 40 of us who boarded the train. He stood at the head of our railroad car, a man of middle age, slender, and of a grace that was on the verge of being ruined by a pot belly. He wore the Marine dress blues. Over this was the regulation tight-fitting overcoat of forest green. Green and blue has always seemed to me an odd combination of colors, and it seemed especially so then. The gaudy dark and light blue of the Marine dress sheathed in sedate and soothing green. "Where you are going, it will not be easy," the gunnery sergeant said. "When you get to Paris Island, you'll find things plenty different from civilian life. You won't like it. You'll think they're overdoing things. You'll think they're stupid. You'll think they're the cruelest, rottenest bunch of men you ever ran into. And I'm going to tell you one thing. You'll be wrong. If you want to save yourself plenty of heartache, you'll listen to me right now. You'll do everything they tell you, and you'll keep your big mouth shut." He could not help grinning at the end. No group of men ever had a saner counselor, and he knew it. But he could not help grinning. He knew we would ignore his every word. "Okay, Sarge," somebody yelled. "Thanks, Sarge." He turned and left us. We called him Sarge. Within another 24 hours, we would not dare address a lowly PFC without the cringing sir. But today, the civilian shine was still upon us. We wore civvies. Hoboken howled around us in the throes of trade. We each had the citizen's polite deprecation of the soldier, and who among us was not certain that he was not long for the ranks? Our ride to Washington was silent and uneventful. But once we had arrived in the capital and had changed trains, the atmosphere seemed to lift. Other Marine recruits were arriving from all over the East. Our contingent was the last to arrive, the last to be crammed aboard the ancient wooden train that waited, puffing, dirty in the dark, smelling of coal, waited to take us down the coast to South Carolina. Perhaps it was because of the dilapidated old train that we brightened and became gay. Such a dingy, tired old relic could not help but provoke mirth. Someone pretended to have found a brass plate beneath one of the seats, and our car rocked with laughter as he read, "This car is the property of the Philadelphia Museum of American History." We had light from kerosene lamps and heat from a pot-bellied stove. Drafts seemed to stream from every angle, and there was a constant creaking and wailing of wood and wheels that sounded like an endless keening. Strange old train that it was, I loved it. Comfort had been left behind in Washington. Some of us already were beginning to revel in the hardship of the train ride. That intangible mystique of the Marine was somehow, even then, at work. We were having it rough, which is exactly what we expected and what we had signed up for. That is the thing, having it rough. The man who has had it roughest is the man to be most admired. Conversely, he who has had it the easiest is the least praiseworthy. Those who wished to sleep could catnap on the floor while the train lurched down through Virginia and North Carolina, but these were few. The singing and the talk were too exciting. The boy sitting next to me, a handsome blonde-haired youth from South Jersey, turned out to have a fine, high voice. He sang several songs alone. There being a liberal leavening of New York Irish among us, he was soon singing Irish ballads. Across the aisle there was another boy, whom I shall call Armadillo because of his lean and pointed face. He was from New York and had attended college there. Being one of the few college men present, he had already established a sort of literary clique. The Armadillo's coterie could not equal another circle farther down the car. This had at its center a stocky, smiling redhead. Red had been a catcher for the St. Louis Cardinals and had once hit a home run at the Polo Grounds off the great Carl Hubbell. There was no measuring the impact of such a celebrity on our group, composed otherwise of mediocrities like myself. Red had been in the big time. He had held daily converse with men who were nothing less than the idols of his newfound comrades. It was quite natural they should ring him round, consult him on everything from pitching form to the Japanese general staff. "What do you think it'll be like at Paris Island, Red?" "Hey, Red, you think the Japs are as tough as the newspapers say they are?" It is an American weakness. The success becomes the sage. Scientists counsel on civil liberty. Comedians and actresses lead political rallies. Athletes tell us what brand of cigarette to smoke. But the redhead was equal to it. It was plain in his case what travel and headlines can do. He was easily the most poised of us all. But I suspect even Red Savoir Fair got a rude jolt when we arrived in Paris Island. We had been taken from the railroad station by truck. When we had dismounted and had formed a motley rank in front of the red brick mess hall, we were subjected to the classic greeting. "Boys," said the sergeant who would be our drill instructor, "boys, I want to tell y'all something. Give your hearts to Jesus, boys, 'cause your ass belongs to me." Then he fell us in after our clumsy civilian fashion and marched us into the mess hall. There were bologna and lima beans. I had never eaten lima beans before, but I did this time. They were cold. The group that had made the trip from New York did not survive the first day in Paris Island. I never saw the blonde singer again, nor most of the others. Somehow 60 of us, among the hundreds who had been aboard that ancient train, became a training platoon, were assigned a number, and placed under the charge of the drill sergeant who had delivered the welcoming address. Sergeant Bello was a southerner with a fine contempt for northerners. It was not that he favored the southerners. He merely treated them less sarcastically. He was big. I would say 6 feet 4 inches, 230 pounds. But above all, he had a voice. It pulsed with power as he counted the cadence, marching us from the administration building to the quartermaster's. It whipped us, this ragged remnant, and stiffened our slouching civilian backs. Nowhere else but in the Marine Corps do you hear that peculiar lilting cadence of command.
Threat for your left! Threat for your left!
It sounds like an incantation, but it is merely the traditional 3-4 your left, elongated by the southern drawl, made sprightly by being sung. I never heard it done better than by our sergeant. Because of this, and because of his inordinate love of drill, I have but one image of him, striding stiff-backed, a few feet apart from us, arms thrust out, hands clenched, head canted back, with the whole body following in the great voice ceaselessly bellowing,
"Threat for your left! Threat for your left!"
Sergeant Bello marched us to the quartermaster's. It was there we were stripped of all vestiges of personality. It is the quartermasters who make soldiers, sailors, and marines. In their presence, one strips down. With each divestment, a trait is lost. The discard of a garment marks the quiet death of an idiosyncrasy. I take off my socks. Gone is a propensity for stripes, or clocks, or checks, or even solids. Ended is a tendency to combine purple socks with brown tie. My socks henceforth will be tan. They will neither be soiled, nor rolled, nor gaudy, nor restrained, nor holy. They will be tan. The only other thing they may be is clean. So it is with it all, until one stands naked, struggling with an embarrassment that is entirely lost on the laconic shades who work in quartermaster sheds. Within, in the depths the psychiatrist calls subliminal, a human spark still sputters. It will never quite go out. Its vigor, or its desuetude, is in exact proportion to the number of miles a man may put between himself and his camp. Thus naked, thus quivering, a man is defenseless before the quartermaster. Character clings to clothes that have gone into the discard, as skin and hair stick to adhesive tape. It is torn from you. Then the quartermaster's shades swarm over you with measuring tape. A cascade of clothes falls upon you, washing you clean of personality. It is as though some monstrous cornucopia poised in the air above has been tilted, and a rain of caps, gloves, socks, shoes, underwear, shirts, belts, pants, coats falls upon your unfortunate head. When you have emerged from this, you are but a number. 351391 USMCR. 20 minutes before, there had stood in your place a human being, surrounded by some 60 other human beings. But now there stood one number among some 60 others. The sum of all to be a training platoon, but the parts to have no meaning except in the context of the whole. We looked alike, as Chinese seemed to Westerners, and, I suppose, vice versa. The color and cut of our hair still saved us, but in a minute these two would fall. The cry rose as we marched to the barber's.
"You'll be sorry!"
Before the last syllable of the taunt had died away, the barber had sheared me. I think he needed 4, perhaps 5 strokes with his electric clipper. The last stroke completed the circle. I was now a number encased in khaki and encompassed by chaos. And it was the second of these twin denominators of Paris Island that was the real operative thing. In 6 weeks of training, there seemed not to exist a single pattern, apart from meals. All seemed chaos, marching, drilling in the manual of arms, listening to lectures on military courtesy.
In saluting, the right hand will strike the head at a 45-degree angle midway of the right eye.
Listening to lectures on Marine jargon.
From now on, everything, floor, street, ground, everything is the deck!
Cleaning and polishing one's rifle until it shone like an ornament. Shaving daily, whether hairy or beardless. It was all a jumble.
What are we gonna do, salute the Japs to death?
Nah, we're gonna blind them with spit and polish. Yeah, or barber the bastards. All the logic seemed to be on our side. The Marine Corps seemed a madness. They had quartered us on the second floor of a wooden barracks, and they kept us there. Save for a week or so on the rifle range, and Sunday masses, I never stirred from that barracks but at the beck of Sergeant Bellow. We had no privileges. We were half-baked, no longer civilians, just becoming Marines. We were like St. Augustine's definition of time. Out of the future that is not yet, into the present that is just becoming, back to the past that no longer is. And always the marching. March to the mess hall, march to the sick bay, march to draw rifles slimy with cosmoline, march to the water racks to scrub them clean, march to the marching ground, feet slapping cement, treading the packed earth, grinding to a halt with rifle butts clashing.
To the rear, march! Forward, march! Left oblique, march! Platoon, halt!
Clash, clash,
right shoulder, arms! Slap, slap, my finger, my red and white finger. God damn it, men, strike y'all pieces, hear me? Strike y'all pieces, you hear? I want noise, I want blood, noise, blood, present, arms!
My finger, forward, march! Now again, march, march, march. It was a madness, but it was discipline. Apart from us recruits, no one in Paris Island seemed to care for anything but discipline. There was absolutely no talk of the war. We heard no fiery lectures about killing Japs, such as we were to hear later on in New River. Everything but discipline, Marine Corps discipline, was steadfastly mocked and ridiculed, be it holiness or high finance. These drill instructors were dedicated martinets. Like the sensualist who feels that if a thing cannot be eaten, drunk, or taken to bed, it does not exist, so were these martinets in their outlook. All was discipline. It is not an attitude to be carried over into pursuit civilian, but it cannot be beaten for straightening civilian backs. Sergeant Bellow was as strict as most. He would discipline us in the ordinary way, command a man to clean out the head with a toothbrush, or sleep with one's rifle because it had been dropped, or worse, called a gun. But above all, he insisted on precision in marching. Once he grabbed me by the ear when I had fallen out of step. I am short, but no lightweight. Yet he all but lifted me off my feet.
"Lucky,"
he said with a grim smile, seemed to delight in mispronouncing my name.
"Lucky, if you don't stay in step, there'll be two of us in the hospital. So's they can get my foot out of your ass!"
Bellow boasted that though he might drill his men into exhaustion beneath that semi-tropical South Carolina sun, he would never march them in the rain.
Magnificent concession!
Yet there were other instructors who not only drilled their charges in the downpour, but seemed to delight in whatever discomfiture they could inflict upon them. One, especially, would march his platoon toward the ocean. His chanted cadence never faltered. If they hesitated, breaking ranks at the water's edge, he would fly into a rage.
"Who do you think you are? You're nothing but a bunch of damn boots! Who told you to halt? I gave the orders here, nobody halts until I tell them to!"
But if the platoon would march on resolutely into the water, he would permit his cadence to subside unnoticed until they had gone knee-deep, or at least to the point where the salt water could not reach their precious rifles. Then he would grin and simulate anger.
"Come back here, you mother's mistakes! Get your stupid behinds out of that ocean!"
Turning, fuming, he would address Paris Island in general.
"Who's got the most stupid platoon on this whole damn island?" "That's right, me! I got it!"
On the whole, the sergeants were not cruel. They were not sadists. They believed in making it tough on us. but they believe this for the purpose of making us turn out tough. Only once did I see something approaching cruelty. A certain recruit could not march without downcast eyes. Sergeant Bellow roared and roared at him until even his iron voice seemed in danger of breaking. At last he hit upon a remedy. The hilt of a bayonet was tucked beneath the belt of the recruit, and the point beneath his throat. Before our round and fearful eyes, he was commanded to march. He did. But when his step faltered, when his eye became fixed and his breathing constricted, the sergeant put an end to it. Something like fear had communicated itself from recruit to sergeant, and Bellow hastened to remove the bayonet. I am sure the sergeant has had more cause to remember this incident than has his victim. 2. It was difficult to form a lasting friendship then. Everyone realized that our unit would be broken up once the boot period ended. Some would go to sea. Most would fill the ranks of the Fleet Marine Force at New River. Others would stay on at Paris Island. Nor was there much chance of camaraderie, confined as we were to those high-ceiled barracks. Warmth there was, yes, but no intimacy. Many friendships were mine in the Marine Corps. But of these I will write in another place. Here the tale concerns a method, the making of Marines. It is a process of surrender. At every turn, at every hour, it seemed, a habit or a preference had to be given up, an adjustment had to be made. Even in the mess hall, we learned that nothing mattered so little as a man's own likes or dislikes. I had always suspected I would not like hominy grits. I found that I did not. I still do not. But on some mornings I ate hominy or went hungry. Often my belly rumbled, ravenously empty until the noon meal. Most of us had established ideas of what passes for good table manners. These did not include the thick sweating arm of a neighbor thrust suddenly across our lips, or the trickle-down from the top method of feeding, whereby the men at the head of the table, receiving the metal serving dishes from the messmen, always dined to repletion, greedily impervious of the indignant shouts of the famished ones in the middle or at the end. Some of us might be disquieted at the sight of knives laden with peas or the wolfish eating noises that some of the men made. But we were becoming less and less sensitive in more and more places. Soon my taste buds served only as intestinal radar to warn me that food was coming, and my sense of propriety deserted for the duration. Worst in all this process of surrender was the ruthless refusal to permit a man the slightest privacy. Everything was done in the open. Rising, waking, writing letters, receiving mail, making beds, washing, shaving, combing one's hair, emptying one's bowels. All was done in public and shaped to the style and stricture of the sergeant. Even food packages from home were seized by the drill instructor. We were informed of their arrival, that the drill instructor had sampled them, that he had found them tasty. What? Now you are aroused. This is too much. This is tampering with the United States mails. Ah, my friend, let me ask you this. Between the United States mails and the United States Marines, who do you say would win? If you are undone in Paris Island, taken apart in those first few weeks, it is at the rifle range that they start to put you together again. Bellow marched us most of the way to the rifle range, about 5 miles, in close-order drill. There is close-order drill, and there is route march, and the first is to the last as standing is to slouching. We had our packs on our backs. Our sea bags would be at the tents when we arrived. We would complain of living out of packs and sea bags, blissfully unaware of the day when either would be a luxury. Then, more than ever, Bellow seemed a thing of stone. Still lance straight, iron voice tireless. Only at the end of the march did it sound a trifle cracked. A heartening sign, as though to assure us there was an impure alloy of us and him, too. We lived in tents at the rifle range, 6 men to a tent. Mine had wooden flooring, which most of the tents did not, and my tentmates and I counted this a great blessing. Nor did we fail to perceive the hand of Providence in keeping us six New Yorkers and Bostonians together. Northern wheat separated from southern chaff. But the morning, the cold coastal morning, brought an end to that flattering notion. Yankee sang-froid was shattered by those rebel yells of glee which greeted the sound of our chattering teeth and the sight of our blue and quivering lips.
Hey, Yank, I thought it was cold up north. Thought you was used to it. Ha! Look at him. Look at them big Yank's lips chattering.
Bella was so tickled he lost his customary reserve.
I guess you're right, Bella said. Every time I come out here, I hear teeth chattering. And every time it's northern teeth.
I don't know, he shook his head.
I don't know. I still can't see how we lost.
In another half hour, the sun would be shining intensely, and we would learn what an alternating hell of hot and cold the rifle range could be. After washing, a surprise awaited us new arrivals in the head. Here was a sort of hurdle on which the men sat, with their rear ends poised above a stained metal trough inclined at an angle down which fresh water coursed. A group had gathered at the front of this trough, where the water was pumped in. Fortunately, I was not among those engaged on the hurdle at the time. I could watch the surprise. One of the crowd had a handful of loosely balled newspapers. He placed them in the water. He lighted them. They caught the current and were off. Howls of bitter surprise and anguish greeted the passing of the fireship beneath the serried white rears of my buddies. Many a behind was singed that morning, and not for as long as we were at the rifle range did any of us approach the trough without misgivings. Of course, we saw the foul trick perpetrated on other newcomers, which was hilarious. We got our inoculations at the rifle range. Sergeant Bello marched us up to the dispensary, in front of which a half-dozen men from another platoon were strewn about in various stages of nausea, as though to warn us what to expect. Getting inoculated is inhuman. It is as though men were being fed into a machine. Two lines of Navy corpsmen stood opposite each other, but staggered so that no one man directly confronted another. We walked through this avenue. As we did, each corpsman would swab the bared arm of the Marine in front of him, reach a hand behind him to take a loaded hypodermic needle from an assistant, then plunge the needle into the Marine's flesh. Thus was created a machine of turning bodies and proffering plunging arms, punctuated by the wickedly glinting arc of the needle, through which we moved, halted, moved on again. It had the efficiency of the assembly line, and also something of the assembly line's inability to cope with human nature. One of my tent mates, called the wrestler because of his huge strength and a brief career in the ring, had no idea of what was happening. He stood in front of me, in position to receive the needle, but he was so big he seemed to be in front of both corpsmen at the same time. While the corpsman on his right was swabbing, jabbing, so was the corpsman on his left. The wrestler took both volleys without a shiver. But then, before my horrified gaze, so quickly that I could not prevent it, the corpsmen went through their arm-waving, grasping motions again and fired two more bursts into the wrestler's muscular arms. This was too much, even for the wrestler.
Hey, how many of these do I get?
One, stupid. Move on.
One? Hell, I've had four already.
Yeah, I know. You're the base commander, too. Get going. I told you. You're holding up the line. I broke in.
He isn't kidding. He did get four. You both gave him two shots.
The corpsman gaped in dismay. They saw unmistakable chagrin on the wrestler's blunt features and something like mirth on mine. They grabbed him and propelled him to one of the dispensary doctors. But the doctor showed no alarm. He made his diagnosis in the context of the wrestler's muscles and iron nerve. How do you feel?
Okay, just burned up.
Good. You're probably all right. If you feel sick or nauseous, let me know. It is the nature of Anticlimax to report that the wrestler did not feel sick. As for nausea, this engulfed the oversensitive among us who witnessed his cavalry charge upon the meatloaf some 15 minutes later. The rifle range also gave me my first full audition of the Marine cursing facility. There had been slight samplings of it in the barracks, but never anything like the utter blasphemy and obscenity of the rifle range. There were non-commissioned officers there who could not put two sentences together without bridging them with a curse, an oath, an imprecation. To hear them made our flesh creep, made those of any depth of religious feeling flush with anger and wish to be at the weather-beaten throats of the blasphemers. We would become inured to it, in time, have it even on our own lips. We would come to recognize it as meaning no offense. But then it shocked us. How could they develop such facility with mere imprecation? This was no vituperation. It was only cursing, obscenity, blasphemy, profanity, none of which is ever profuse or original, yet it came spouting out in an amazing variety. Always there was the word. Always there was that four-letter ugly sound that men in uniform have expanded into the single substance of the linguistic world. It was a handle, a hyphen, a hyperbole, verb, noun, modifier, yes, even conjunction. It described food, fatigue, metaphysics. It stood for everything and meant nothing. An insulting word. It was never used to insult. Crudely descriptive of the sexual act, it was never used to describe it. Base, it meant the best. Ugly, it modified beauty. It was the name and the nomenclature of the voice of emptiness. But one heard it from chaplains and captains, from PFCs and PhDs, until finally one could only surmise that if a visitor unacquainted with English were to overhear our conversations, he would, in the way of the higher criticism, demonstrate by measurement and numerical incidents that this little word must assuredly be the thing for which we were fighting. On the firing line, angry sergeants filled the air with their cursing. While striving to make riflemen of us in what had become an abbreviated training course, Marines must learn to fire standing, prone, and sitting. Perhaps because the sitting position is the hardest to learn, that posture had some sort of vogue at the Paris Island rifle range. They impressed the fashion upon us for two whole days on that miserable island's blasted, blistering sand dunes. We sat in the sun with sand in our hair, our ears, our eyes, our mouths. The sergeants didn't care where the sand was, as long as it was not on the oiled metal parts of our precious rifles. There was no mercy for the unfortunate man who permitted this to happen. Punishment came swiftly. A hard kick and a horrible oath screamed directly into the miscreant's ear. To assume the sitting position, as the sergeant instructor would say, was to inflict upon yourself the stretching torture of the rack. The rifle was held in the left hand, at the center or balance of the piece. But the left arm had been inserted through a loop of the rifle sling, which was run up the arm to the bicep, where it was drawn unbelievably tight. Thus held, while sitting with the legs crossed, Buddha style, the butt of the rifle was some few inches away from the right shoulder. The trick was to fit that butt snugly against the right shoulder, so that you could lay the cheek alongside the right hand, sight along the barrel, and fire. The first time I tried it, I concluded it to be impossible. Unless my back would part down the middle, permitting each side of my torso to swing around and to the front as though hinged. Otherwise, no. Otherwise, the sling would cut my left arm in two, or my head would snap off from the strain of turning my neck, or I would have to risk it and aim the rifle single-handed as a pistol. Fortunately, if I may use the word, the decision was not mine. Sergeant Bellow came over.
Trouble? He inquired sweetly. His manner should have warned me, but I mistook it for an unsuspected human shrink.
Yes, sir.
My gracious.
It was too late. I was caught. I looked up at him with dumb pleading eyes.
Okay, lad. You just get that rifle firmly in the left hand. Fine. Now the right. My, my, that is hard, ain't it?
Whereupon Sergeant Bellow sat on my right shoulder. I swear I heard it crack. I thought I was done. but I suppose it did nothing more than stretch a few ligaments. It worked. My right shoulder met the rifle butt, and my left arm remained unsevered. And that was how I learned the unprofitable sitting position of shooting. I saw but one Jap killed by a shot fired from the sitting position. And this only when no fire was coming from the enemy. Still, it was amazing how the Marines could teach us to shoot within the few days they had us on the range. That is, teach the remarkable few among us who needed an instruction. Most of us knew how to shoot. Even surprisingly, the big city boys. I have no idea how or where, in the steel and concrete wilderness of our modern cities, these boys had developed prowess in what seems a countrified pastime. But shoot they could, and well. All the Southerners could shoot. Those from Georgia and the border state of Kentucky seemed the best. They suffered the indignity of the rifle sling while snapping in on the sand dunes. But when live ammunition was issued and the shooting butts were run up, they scorned such a feat support, cuddled the rifle butts under their chins, and blazed away. The drill instructors let them get away with it. After all, there is no arguing of a bullseye. I was one of those unacquainted with powder. I had never fired a rifle before, except an occasional .22 in a carnival shooting gallery or the gaudy arcades of Midtown New York. A .30-caliber Springfield seemed to me a veritable cannon. First time I sat on the firing line, with 2 5-round clips beside me, and the warning, "Load and lock!" floating up from the gunnery sergeant, I felt as a small animal must feel upon the approach of an automobile. Then came the feared commands. "All ready on the firing line! Fire! Boom!" It was the fellow on my right. The sound seemed to split my eardrums. I jumped. Then the entire line became a splitting, roaring cauldron of sound, and I got my Springfield working with the rest of them, firing, ejecting, reloading. The 10 rounds were gone in seconds. Silence came, and with it a ringing in my ears. They still ring. It was not long before I overcame my timidity and began to enjoy shooting. Of course, I made the mistakes all neophytes make. Shooting at the wrong target. Shooting under the bullseye. Getting my windage wrong. But I progressed, and when the day came to fire for record, I had the monumental conceit to expect I would qualify as an expert. An expert rifleman's badge is to shooting what the Medal of Honor is to bravery. It even brought $5 a month extra pay, a not inconsiderable sum to one earning 21. The day when we shot for record, that is, when our scores would be official and determine whether we qualified or not, dawned windy and brutally cold. I remember it as dismal, and that I longed to be near the fires around which the sergeants clustered, smoking cigarettes and forcing a gaiety I am sure no one could feel. My eyes ran water all day. When we fired from the 600-yard range, I think I could just about make out the target. I failed miserably. I qualified for nothing. A handful qualified as marksmen, 2 or 3 as sharpshooters, none as experts. Once we had shot for record, we were Marines. There were a few other skills to be learned, the block parry thrust of bayonet drill or pistol shooting, but these had no high place in the Marine scale of values. The rifle is the Marine's weapon. So it was that we marched back to the barracks, with our chests swelling of pride and our feet slapping the pavement, with the proud precision of men who had mastered the Springfield, or at least pretended that they had. We were veterans. When we arrived at the barracks, our path crossed that of a group of incoming recruits, still in civilian clothes, seeming to us unkempt, bedraggled as birds caught in the rain. As though by instinct, we shouted with one voice, "You'll be sorry!" Bellow grinned with delight. 3. In 5 weeks, they had made us over. Another week of training remained, but the desired change already had taken place. Most important in this transformation was not the hardening of my flesh or the sharpening of my eyes, but the new attitude of mind. I was a Marine. Automatically, this seemed to raise me above the plodding herd of servicemen. I would speak disparagingly of soldiers as dog faces and sailors as swab jockeys. I would guffaw when the sergeant referred scathingly to West Point as that boys' school on the Hudson. I would accept as gospel truth those unverifiable accounts of Army or Navy officers resigning their commissions to sign up as Marine privates. I would acquire a store of knowledge covering the history of the Corps, and would delight in relating anecdotes pointing up the invincibility of the embattled Marine. To anyone but another Marine, I would become insufferable. For the next week or so, we merely went through the motions while awaiting assignment. We talked easily of sea duty or guard duty. In these waking dreams, we all wore dress blue uniforms, drank copiously, danced, copulated, and generally played the gallant. Occasionally, as the name of a family miscreant haunts the conversation of reunions, the name of New River popped up. This is the base where the 1st Marine Division was forming. At New River, there were no dress blues, no girls, no dance bands. There was only beer and that marshland called the Boondocks. To mention New River was to produce painful pauses in the talk until it would be forgotten in the next onrush of happy speculation. The day for departure came. We swung our sea bags onto supply trucks. We donned our packs. We fell out gaily on the sidewalk before the barracks. We stood in the shadow of the balcony, a place made odious to us one day when, to punish a Butterfingers who had dropped his rifle, Bello had commanded him to stand there, erect, rifle at port arms, chanting from sunup to sundown, "I'm a bad boy. I dropped my rifle." There we stood, awaiting orders. Bello fell us in. He ran us through the manual of arms. Our hands, slapping the rifle slings, made sure sounds. "At ease! Fall out! Get on those trucks!" We scrambled aboard. Someone at last mustered the courage to inquire, "Where are we going, Sergeant?" "New River." The trucks drove off in silence. I remember Bello watching as we pulled away, and how astonished I was to see the sadness in his eyes. We arrived at New River in darkest night. We had come from South Carolina by rail. There had been a good meal in the diner, as there always was in train travel. We had slept in our seats, packs on the racks above us, rifles by our sides. They fell us out of the train with much shouting and flashing of lights, and we formed ranks on the siding. All was shadowy. None of these yelling, rushing figures, the NCOs and officers who received us, seemed related to reality, except in those moments when a flashlight might pin one of them against the darkness. Black as it was, I was still able to gain the impression of vastness, the dome of heaven arching darkly overhead and stretching away from us, a limitless flatness broken only by silent huts. They marched us quickly to a lighted oblong hut, with a door at either end. We stood at one end, while an NCO called our names. "Lackey!" I detached myself from my platoon, ending in that motion my association with the majority of the men who had been my comrades for 6 weeks. I walked quickly into the lighted hut. An enlisted man bade me sit down opposite his desk. There were three or four others like him in the hut, similarly interviewing new arrivals. He asked questions rapidly, interested only in my answers, ignoring me. Name, serial number, rifle number, etc. All the dry detail that tells nothing of a man. "What'd you do in civilian life?" "Newspaper, sports writer." "Okay, 1st Marines, go out front and tell the sergeant." That was how the Marines classified us. The questions were perfunctory. The answers were ignored. Schoolboy, farmer, scientist of the future. All were grist to the reception mill and all came forth neatly labeled 1st Marines. There were no aptitude tests, no job analyses. In the 1st Marine Division, the presumption was that a man had enlisted to fight. No one troubled about civilian competence. It may have been an affront to those vestiges of civilian self-esteem which Paris Island had not had time to destroy. But New River would soon take care of that. Here, the only talent was that of the foot soldier. The only tool, the handgun. Here, the cultivated, the oblique, the delicate soon perished, like gardenias in the desert. I felt the power of that attitude, and I felt, for the first time in my life, an utter submission to authority as I emerged from the lighted hut and mumbled, "First Marines," to a cluster of sergeants standing there expectantly. One of them pointed with his flashlight to a group of men. I took my place among them. About a half dozen other groups were being formed in the same way. Then, at a command, I swung up on a truck with my new comrades. The driver started the motor and we rolled off, bumping over pitted muddy roads, past row upon row of silent darkened huts, rolling, ever rolling until suddenly we stopped with a lurch and were home. Home was H Company, 2nd Battalion, 1st Marine Regiment. Home was a company of machine guns and heavy mortars. Someone in that cheerless hut had decided I should be a machine gunner. The process of enrollment in H Company hardly differed from the method of our assignment the night before, except that we were run through a hut occupied by Captain High Hips. He fixed us with his gloriously militant glass eye. He fingered his military mustache and he questioned us in his clipped British manner of speech. Then, with an air of skepticism, he signed us to our squad huts and into the keeping of the NCOs now arriving from other regiments. These men came from the 5th and the 7th. The veteran line units in whose ranks were almost all of the 1st Division's trained troops. My regiment, the 1st, had been disbanded, but now, after Pearl Harbor, it was being reactivated. The 1st needed NCOs, and many of those who came to us betrayed by a certain nervousness of voice, a newness of rank. Their chevrons were shiny. A few had not found time to set them onto their sleeves. They were pinned on. A few weeks before, these corporals and PFCs had been privates. Some predated us as Marines by that margin only. But in such an urgent time, experience, however slight, is preferred to none at all. The table organization had to be filled. So up they went. But the 1st also received a vital leavening of veteran NCOs. They would teach us. They would train us. They would turn us into fighting troops. From them we would learn our weapons. From them we would take our character and temper. They were the old breed. And we were the new, the volunteer youths who had come from the comfort of home to the hardship of war. For the next 3 years, all of these would be my comrades. The men of the 1st Marine Division. Chapter 2. Marine. 1. Huts, oil, beer. Around these three, as around a sacramental triad, revolved our early life at New River. Huts to keep us dry, oil to keep us warm, beer to keep us happy. It is no unholy jest to call them sacramental. They had about them the sanctity of earth. When I remember New River, I remember the oblong huts with the low roofs. I remember the oil stoves and how we slipped out at night, buckets in hand, to pilfer oil from the other company's drums. Passing the men from the other companies, thieves in the night like ourselves, I remember the cases of canned beer in the middle of the hut, and how we had pulled our every penny to go down to the slop chute to buy them, carrying them back boisterously on our shoulders, shouting and cheerful, because the warm, dry huts awaited us, and soon the beer would be in our bellies, and the world would be ours. We were privates, and who was more carefree? Like the huts, oil, and beer, I had a trinity of friends. Hoosier, the Chuckler, and the Runner. I met Hoosier the second day at New River. He had arrived 2 days before us, and Captain High Hips had made him his runner. In that first unorganized week, his clothes were always spattered with mud from his countless trips through the mire between the captain's office and the other huts. I disliked him at first. He seemed inclined to look down on us from his high position in Captain High Hip's office. He seemed surly, too, with his square, strong figure, tow hair and blue eyes, His curt intelligence is from on high. Captain wants two men bringing the lieutenant's box. But I was too inexperienced to see the surliness was but a front for his being scared. Like all of us. The immobile face was a facade. The forced downward curve of the mouth a hastily erected defense against the unknown. With time and friendship, that mouth would curve in a different direction, upward in a grin that was pure joy. Chuckler was easier to know. We became friends the first day of a gun drill, our introduction into the mysteries of the heavy, water-cooled 30-caliber machine gun. Corporal Smoothface, our instructor, a soft-voiced, sad-eyed youth from Georgia, made the drill a competition between the squads to see which one could get its gun into action sooner. As gunner, Chuckler carried the tripod. As assistant gunner, I lugged the gun, a metal incubus of some 20 pounds. At a command, Chuckler raced off to a given point, spun the tripod over his head and set it up, while I panted off after him to slip the gun spindle into the tripod socket. We beat the other squad, and the Chuckler growled of satisfaction. "Attaboy, Jersey," he chuckled, as I slid alongside him and placed the machine gun box in feeding position. "Let's show them bastards." That was his way. He was fiercely competitive. He was profane. He had a way of chuckling, a sort of perpetual good humor that stopped his aggressiveness short of push, and which softened the impact of his rough language. Like Hoosier and me, he was stocky, and like Hoosier, he was fair, but he had a rugged handsomeness that the Hoosier's blunt features could not match. The three of us, and later the runner who joined us on Onslow Beach, were all stocky and somewhere under 5 feet 10 inches tall, a good build for carrying guns or tripods or the tubes and base plates which the men of our mortar section had to lug. And flinging these heavy pieces about seemed to constitute all of our training. Gun drill and nomenclature. Know your weapon. Know it intimately. Know it with almost the insight of its inventor. Be able to take it apart blindfolded or in the dark. To put it together. Be able to recite mechanically a detailed description of the gun's operation. Know the part played by every member of the squad, from gunner down to the unfortunates who carried the water can or the machine gun boxes, as well as their own rifles. It was dull and it was depressing, and the war seemed very far away. It was always difficult to remain attentive, to keep from falling asleep under that warm Carolina sun, while the voice of the gunnery sergeant droned on, "Enemy approaches 600 yards! Up two, right three, fire!" But for every hour, there was a 10-minute break in which we might talk and smoke and clown around. Hoosier and I were the clowns. He loved to mimic the battalion executive officer, the major, who had a mincing walk and a prim manner that was almost a caricature in itself. "All right, men," said the Hoosier, sashaying back and forth before us like the major, "let's get this straight. There'll be no thinking. No enlisted man is permitted to think. The moment you think, you weaken this outfit. Anyone caught thinking will be subject to a general court-martial. Anyone in H Company having brains will immediately return them to the quartermaster. They're running short of them up in officer's country." In these times, we would also sing. Neither the Hoosier nor I could carry a tune, our idea of a scale being to raise or lower our voices. But we liked to bellow out the words. Unfortunately for us, for all of us, we had no songs to sing except those tuneless, pointless war songs then arriving in a sticky flood. Refrains like, "Just to show all those Japs, the Yanks are no saps," or "I threw a kiss in the ocean," hardly fill a man with an urge to kill or conquer. After a few days of singing these, we came to scorn them and turned to singing the bodies, which are at least rollicking. It is sad to have to go off to war without a song of your own to sing. Something like a rousing war song, something like the Minstrel Boy, or something jolly and sardonic like the Englishman's Sixpence, might have made the war a bit more worth fighting. But we got none. Ours was an advanced age, too sophisticated for such outdated frippery. War cries or war songs seemed rather naive and embarrassing in our rational time. We were fed food for thought, Abstractions like the four freedoms were given us. Sing a marching song about that, if you can. If a man must live in mud and go hungry and risk his flesh, you must give him a reason.